This is the Medicast, April 21st, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 114. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. If you are a brand new listener to the Medicast, just checking out the show for the first time, I want to welcome you to the Medicast and to the community that is the Medicast. If you haven't already done so, head over to medicast.com. Check out the links there to take you to the show notes and blog for this particular episode. Also, the other shows that make up the Medicast network. And learn a little bit about the past episodes and find out that you can find links to everything we talk about here, plus all of the other studies, research, commentary, and news that I put up on the blog throughout the course of the week. All can be found over at medicast.com. Of course, if you are a long-term listener, I want to thank you for being a loyal member to the show and coming back and checking out the show and all of your comments, your suggestions, and your, yes, corrections, if I make a mistake. Keep me straight here, folks. This is a community effort, and it's my job here to provide you, the EMS community, with access to your news and commentary about what's been going on in EMS, as well as great access to tips, tricks, medications, and everything else, all here at the Medicast podcast. I'm very excited later on to be sharing with you a new advertiser for the Medicast that is going to offer everybody that listens to the show significant savings, and I'm always excited to pass on those kind of special deals on to you guys, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But first off, it's time to talk a little bit about listener mail and forums and voicemail, so let's get into that. First off, let's talk a little bit about the forums over at forums.medicast.com, a great community effort over there where you can pose questions, help answer other people's questions, and really has turned into a very wonderful place for people to follow up and get information. And there have been some great discussions started over there. Elm has started a few good discussions, as well as a few others. Tim Toth is bringing up issues dealing with treatment and transport of minors. So head over to the forums.medicast.com. Read some of the forum posts. You can share your questions, share answers with each other. You can even share photos and video there, all at the Medicast forums. It's free to register and get signed up, and you can go ahead and start posting and share the things you have to say over at the Medicast forums. I urge you to head over there and check it out. It's a great way to stay involved here at the Medicast community. Seems like it was voicemail week here at the Medicast, and I got a couple of good voicemail options in to play for you here. And I want to thank everybody that does share things by voicemail. The voicemail number for the Medicast is 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342. 30 medic. Put that in your cell phones, folks. When you're listening to the Medicast and you want to chime in, pause your player and go ahead and call and let me know what you think. And leave a message there and let me know what's going on. Listener Christopher did, and he has a couple of comments about mass casualty incidents and dealing with students at school bus MVAs. And Christopher, thanks for sharing your comments here. Here's what Christopher had to say.
CMT intermediate and paramedic student in Eastern North Carolina. I just want to call, make a couple comments on your show that had to deal with mass casualty training and your bus incidents. First off, on mass casualty training and hazmat, my recommendation is anyone who has any interest in this needs to go back in the archives of the EMSresponder.com podcast. Look for one from Greg Fries. He went to Israel and did the Israeli terrorism workshop. Very informative, big eye-opener, and if anybody has any justification for an expertise on mass casualties and terrorism, it would be the Israelis, because they deal with about 8 a year, according to the podcast, if I remember correctly. Excellent one. You can find it in the archives, probably at emsresponder.com. Greg Freese is the podcaster. Second, on the bus incidents, I talk about bus accidents. My county has developed local protocols to handle bus accidents in relation to minors involved in the accident and who is to be there to claim responsibility for the patient's well-being. Our protocol, I do not know the exact term, the exact phrasing. Essentially, uninjured students, once cleared by a paramedic and, I believe, medical direction, can be released on one blanket form by name to the principal or superintendent of the school, minimum principal, and he can sign for the students as their responsible guardian for that incident to return them to the school so they can be seen by their parents and taken possibly to a family doctor for further evaluation. Any other patients deemed needed transport by EMS get transported by EMS. That's under the medical direction. I think that you're right to transport every student on the bus would be an overtaxing. Transportation for students not being required seen in the ED would be provided by having another bus arrive on scene and transport them to the school so they could be grouped up with their parents so that parents can make decisions from there. We put it on the school officials. One incident, the school official did not feel comfortable with it. I cannot remember how that one was handled. It was a smaller incident. Long-time listener, I usually pick you up after I've downloaded a couple of your podcasts and listen to them in the truck. Have a good day.
Hey, Christopher, you have a good day, too. And thank you for taking the time to call into the show and share your thoughts on those issues. And I think it's very important for all of you to kind of look into your own protocols and think about these things before they happen to you. It's not something we are all going to run into in the course of our careers or, you know, even more than once in a career if you do run into it. It's something that just doesn't happen that frequently, thank goodness. But dealing with things like school bus accidents and mass casualty incidents, planning ahead is what it's all about. So, Christopher, thanks for your comments there. I also got a rather interesting recording from our good friend Tim down in Australia, who wanted to send us a little bit of radio chatter from a consult that he was able to record for us. It's Don't worry, it's no patient information compromise here, no identifiable stuff, even if HIPAA were to reach all the way to Australia. But it is a good look at how things, even though they're different, remain the same. This particular item has to do with a victim of a stab wound being transported to the hospital. You'll hear him say things like describing the wound and giving vital signs, talking about being hemodynamically stable, and so talking about being cannulated as far as having an IV in place. So listen to that, and it's just like a consult here at home, but I thought it would be interesting to hear just exactly how much alike we are with the way people are doing things in other parts of the world. And Tim, thank you for sending this in for the listeners here.
It's been a stab wound with a nice 20 centimeter blade right up a quadrant. Unsure of how far inserted, possibly about 5-7 meters. Patient's blood pressure at the moment is 120. Pulse, 88. Patient's cannulated. Hartman's been set up at the moment. Patient at the moment is hemodynamically stable. ETA and the plan be about 10 minutes.
Copy that.
So there you go, folks. A little bit of chatter from down under and a bit of understanding that a consult is the same no matter where you come from, and good information without being information overload to let somebody know about what's coming into the hospital from a particular call. So thanks a lot, Tim, again, for sending that in. Time now for this week's link of the week, and I want to take everybody back to a link I haven't really headed over to in a while, and that's Peter Canning's Streetwatch blog. Streetwatch Notes of a Paramedic is a great resource for all of us in the EMS community to learn more about patient care and how we do things. And Peter does a great job of relaying his experiences in the field in such a way that every call ends up being a learning experience. And I just can't say enough about it. Peter shares his thoughts in such a great way. He's a fantastic writer, and I urge you to head over and check it out. You can find his blog over at medicscribe.blogspot.com. There'll be a link in the show notes, of course, but you can also Google Streetwatch, Notes of a Paramedic, and you'll probably find out more about him over there. Peter's a novelist, has written several stories, books that are for sale. You can find more about them over at the MedicCast store if you want, or any bookseller online, I think, has access to them. Peter's a great writer and a great resource for the EMS community, and heck, I haven't talked to Peter in a while. I probably need to drop him a line. I haven't talked to him in ages, so I'll have to do that. But in the meantime, you get an opportunity to check out his blog yourself and find out why I get so excited about reading his content every time I get over there. Time now to jump into this week's news, and I'll start off with a story coming out of Idaho, Cassia County, Idaho, to be specific. A committee secretary for the county EMS committee wanted to talk a little bit to some of the county government members about the need for more support for the volunteer system there and to assist more volunteers to get fully trained to assist their community. And this is a great story that looks at some of the issues facing many communities around the United States, and I suspect around the world in areas that may be served by a volunteer responder service, at least for initial response. And in this case, they're talking about the amount of hours required, either for EMT, where you need 140 hours or more of schooling, or perhaps 24 hours of continuing education for EMTs, all the way up to looking at how to help assist people to get just the first responder training, which is a 45-hour certification program. And so the committee chair, Mike Lewis, was looking at how the county commissioners could find a better way to support the volunteers as well as support expanding the county dispatch office so that they could receive more funding to hire an additional dispatcher and more funding to support the volunteers in their community. Because, of course, without those volunteers, they'd have to support a paid service, which would be a whole lot more expensive. So I think it's important for all of us, especially those served by volunteer communities, even in part, to go out and look at this article and others like it and try to bring some of the ideas proposed here back to our own local governments and to find out about what you can do in your community to help support that system, whether it's assisting with training and assisting with providing funding in your community or going out and doing active fundraising in your community. Either way, it's a great way for you to help bring those resources back so that they can provide the help and first response that a community needs from their EMS group. The next item kind of really bothers me, and I guess it shouldn't surprise me, but it still bothers me. And it has to do with the Congress's recent selling of the old TV band airwaves. As the United States switches over to a digital television system, they are selling off the old VHF bandwidth. Very good bandwidth. It travels far. It goes through buildings. It's a great transmission wavelength and frequency range. And so part of what they were proposing was that there would be a section of that bandwidth would be required to be set up for a national EMS and emergency response frequency range that would enable agencies to speak to each other. And this was something that came about as a result of the 9/11 report, and it seemed like everybody was on board. And yet, the congressional panel overseeing the sale is asking some hard questions of the Federal Communications Commission, who wants to know why they were unable to pitch successfully this program. The bandwidth that is out there to be sold was available for use for commercial purposes as long as a portion of it was set aside and set up specifically for emergency response access. So these companies would be required to provide some of their bandwidth for free to local emergency response services. And what's wrong with that? I mean, they would have bid appropriately on this. Well, apparently, a former FCC chairman was involved in a program that was looking at this, and there are some allegations that his involvement may have scared away other bidders. And then when he backed out and his organization and backers were failed to come up with the funding required to make a bid, there were no other bidders in place. And so what happens? Well, like so often happens, the Emergency Response Network of the United States gets the short end of the stick, and we're going to be expected to do what we need to do without any kind of federally accessible interoperability. There should be a way for us to do this. There's no excuse for us to have a way to do this. The public owns the bandwidth and airwaves in this country, and yet Congress and the FCC failed miserably, as usual, to do what they needed to do to help ensure our safety, to help ensure that we can respond appropriately, that we can talk to each other from agency to agency. And so when there are problems like Hurricane Katrina and people from all over the country head down there to respond, wouldn't it be great if there was a national bandwidth frequency range that we could tune our radios to and talk to each other? I mean, wouldn't it be great? Of course it would. And yet again, they've dropped the ball. So there's a whole article on this over at emsresponder.com. I've got a link in the show notes. You can obviously tell that I'm a little pissed off about it. They sold off all of the other bandwidth to the commercial companies that will probably use it to gouge us for things that we don't really need. $19.1 billion was money that was raised to begin to use this bandwidth, and yet they were unable to get anybody to nibble on the fact that they needed to give something back. So I'm hoping, you know, $19.1 billion, I think about half of that should go towards building an effective training and response communications network for the entire country. Let's make it easy for all of us to be able to talk to each other. Let's make it easy for all of us to get access to training and information. Heck, let's start up an EMS television and radio network or a emergency services television and radio network. I'll be the first to sign on. Let's put the Medicast on there. Let's put the nursing show on there. Let's put all of the great resources like Rick Rosati's Mitigation Journal and EMS Live and all of the other programs and products and podcasts that are out there on a network that everyone can access easily and nationally without having to use your own computers and our own bandwidth to do it. Well, come on, Congress, time for you to step up and do it. You know, we're in the middle of an election year, folks, and I don't care which way you vote. I just hope you're willing to vote for supporting your jobs, supporting the work we do in the community, and talking to the people that are running for Congress in your area, find out if they really do support the fire and EMS services out there. And if they don't, put them to task. Get out there and talk about how somebody else needs to do their job and make sure that things like this don't happen in the future. All right, I'm going to get off my soapbox, but you know, I just couldn't let that one slide by. The next item in the news is also something that might have to do with bandwidth. Imagine if we had a nationally accessible emergency frequency that we could use to transmit patient information or data from our ever-increasingly smart devices back to the hospital. Well, interestingly enough, I found an article about ECG telemetry devices, and an analyst from this industry, you know, a business analyst, that is predicting that the telemetry device market is going to reach $909 million within the next 2 years. And that's pretty exciting because of all of the great devices we have in the back of our unit that have electronic access to them. Imagine having a device that has a Bluetooth chip in it that allows your heart monitor to talk to a cell phone device or a radio transmitter in your vehicle, and using that Bluetooth access point, send patient telemetry data live, real time, to the hospital. They can look at ongoing 12-lead access. They can look at patients' vital signs, their pulse oximetry, their capnography readings. We can start transmitting information on things like lab values if we start doing field lab work. All of these things can be done, and easily accessed, and it's really interesting to see that this marketplace is expected to take off like it is. So an interesting look at the business side of EMS, but I thought it was interesting to point out that this marketplace is alive and well. Finally, I'll wrap up with a story on a looming paramedic and EMS strike in Los Angeles County, affecting multiple sections of that area. American Medical Response contracts with the County of Los Angeles to provide EMS services countywide. And a union representing 300 of the Los Angeles area AMR employees has rejected a recent proposal by the company and said that the membership has voted to begin to strike starting May 2nd if the contract is not seriously revised. Now, their contract has been expired since September, and the union has signed multiple extensions on that contract in order to continue to bargain with the company. They're asking for, and this should be no surprise, improved wages and increases in the employer's side of the health insurance contribution. Basically, what the union has been saying is that they are dealing in an area that is becoming increasingly expensive just to live, that these companies are expecting to provide EMS services, and the residents of that area are expecting them to provide EMTs and paramedics to staff their vehicles, but these people can't even afford to live nearby, and they need more money to cover their expenses, as well as their health insurance. And this has been a problem in any marketplace, in any labor workforce, and it's not surprising that this is coming to a head in EMS as well. I expect to see more issues like this come up, especially as the cost of gas continues to increase. In these areas where it's expensive to maintain a home, a lot of these people commute a long distance to get to work from areas where it's less expensive to live, and yet as the cost of gas approaches $4 or more a gallon, it is going to be increasingly prohibitive for these people to drive those distances. Heck, they can work a cheaper job closer to home and end up with more money in their pocket, with probably fewer hours and more time with their family. You know, we've got to do something here to step up and start providing good, reasonable compensation for our medical professionals in the pre-hospital arena and stop treating them like simply transport drivers and common laborers. So I'd like to see more on this, and I'd really like to see AMR step up and provide for their workforce, or they're going to be in trouble because they've contracted to provide EMS services, and I don't see them having a way to cover that gap if they lose 300 employees for a significant amount of time in the Los Angeles area. We'll have more on this as it continues to develop. All right, the news is done, and it's time for this week's tip and trick of the week. And I thought I would bring out something that I had pre-recorded this week because we had a great time this past week at the Stump the Pod Medic episode at the MedicCast Live this past Thursday night. A lot of good questions came up. I talked a lot about continuing education kinds of classes in that particular episode, and also answered questions from the listeners. Listener Shirley raised an interesting question, though, about the recent American Heart Association guideline changes and how they applied to us. And it occurred to me while I was answering that question that if she had that question, I'll be willing to bet that a lot of you had a similar question. How does the recent change in the American Heart Association recommendations for compression-only CPR affect us in the EMS community? So here's a bit of my response to Shirley's question and give you a taste of what kind of things we were talking about this past Thursday night at the MedicCast Live for the Stump the Pod Medic episode. Incidentally, for those of you that are MedicCast Extra members, you will be getting the other segments from this hour and 40-minute marathon live show. You'll be getting each of the other segments separated out by their content area for you over at the MedicCast Extra. I'll be posting those up a couple of times throughout the course of this week so that you'll be able to listen to those segments in sections and pick the ones you want to listen to directly. The rest of you, you can listen to the whole show over at MedicCast Live, and hear everything we talked about. It was a great episode. You can go to MedicCastLive.com to find out more about that. And if you're interested in the MedicCast Extra service, you can go to MedicCast.com/extra for more on how you can get access to the individual segments. Shirley asks the question, are there new guidelines with the AHA with regard to healthcare provider CPR? Is it still 30 to 2, or does the new guidelines that were announced recently affect Heart Saver with the 30 to 2 ratio? Shirley, you may be referring to the recent news stories out there regarding the American Heart Association's response and looking at the compression only part of the algorithm. And this was something that was actually discussed prior to the 2005 update, but there weren't enough people at the AHA on board to bring it into effect. What exactly the American Heart Association talked about in their recent press release was that they were making a recommendation here in the United States in a very specific situation to advocate the use of compression-only CPR. And I qualify that by saying in a very specific situation. So what is that situation? Well, here it is in a nutshell. Bystander, civilian, witnessed collapse. Okay? Let me put those four things together. Bystander and civilian. They go together. This is not for healthcare providers. This is for bystanders and civilians that they can perform compression-only CPR. It must be witnessed, and it must be a cardiac arrest. Okay? So they have to have this witness situation. If they haven't seen dad all night and they walk into the bedroom and they didn't witness him collapse, well, that's not a witnessed arrest. And that person, if they are indeed a candidate for CPR, is going to need full CPR with ventilations. So they're not downplaying the ventilations. So to understand their reasoning behind this, we have to look at some of the data that the American Heart Association pulled in on this particular issue. One of the things that the American Heart Association is focusing on a lot right now is specific problems with response in our communities. And there's only so many things we can do from our end on the EMS end. They've addressed a lot of those. They've changed the ratios, made it 30 to 2. They've talked a lot and retrained us on providing good, adequate compressions, not getting off the heart for more than 10 seconds at a time, shock, one shock, and then right back into CPR. Don't check for pulses right away. These are the things that we can do based on the science and the studies that have been done over the last few years. But there's still a hole in the chain. You know, if you look at the chain of survival that you teach if you're a CPR instructor or if you are a CPR student, you're looking at that chain of survival. What's the first thing in the chain of survival? Early access. So that's early call to 911, early CPR, early defibrillation, and early advanced care. Okay, those are the four parts of the chain of survival. Well, we can do early defibrillation. We have our defibrillators. If you're a BLS unit, you have an AED. Even if you're in the community at large, you may have an AED. And we have access to early advanced care. Everybody out there has some kind of advanced life support coming when there's a cardiac arrest. And maybe not close, but at least they've been dispatched. So what about the first two? Well, early access, okay. People are pretty good about calling 911. The hole is in early CPR, and the hole is actually in bystander CPR. When you witness an arrest at work, on the street, in your home, what do you do? Now, you and I, we're all trained providers, right? We're going to go ahead and provide care to the best of our ability. But for these people on the street or in the workplace, maybe you've gotten CPR training, but maybe you don't want to do full CPR because there isn't a pocket mask nearby. One of the things I do when I teach CPR classes, everybody gets some kind of barrier device. Okay. I provide an inexpensive keychain style plastic face mask barrier device. Okay. the cheapest thing out there. It's basically cellophane with a one, you know, with a filter mask portion of it. But I highly encourage everybody to go out and get yourself a barrier device, and I provide them when I teach CPR in the community, because that's part of what I believe is part of my service. But what about the bystander that doesn't have that barrier device? Well, guess what? They're not going to do ventilations. No way, no how, no matter how you tell them how to do it, no matter how many times you tell them that it's highly unlikely they're going to contract any illness, that it's unlikely that they'll catch anything giving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, they're just not going to do it. So here's what goes through their minds, and this has been one of the things that the American Heart Association has studied. They have looked at the bystander CPR responses and the reasons why CPR was not performed or people would not perform CPR, and it came down to providing ventilations for patients. Now, you would say, okay, well, just do compressions. Well, that's not what they learned, right? They learned you have to do CPR 30 to 2 until help comes. Well, if they're not going to do the 2, they don't want to do any of it. So they choose not to do any CPR because they can't do the right CPR. So the American Heart Association looked long and hard at this, and they decided that in specific instances where patients were most viable, okay, and those are the patients that go immediately into collapse, right? These patients were just breathing a minute ago. They just maybe took a big breath, right? We've seen patients that are in that last gasp stage. Well, that last gasp is hyperoxygenating the lungs. So these patients were just breathing. Well, all right, everybody stop for a second and hold your breath. Go ahead, I'll wait. Now, while you're holding your breath, I'm going to keep talking. But I want you to think about, look at a clock or something. How long can you hold your breath? I mean, really, before you start really feeling the urge that you have to take a breath again, most people can hold their breath anywhere between 60 seconds and 3 minutes. And people are different depending on how healthy you are, how athletic you are, whether you smoke or not. But most people can hold their breath for 60 seconds to 3 minutes without too much difficulty. Okay? That seems like a long time. And in fact, it is. And if you think about the fact that there's still oxygen present in that person's lungs, doing just compressions on them will be just fine because there's still oxygen in their lungs. And when help arrives, what's the first thing we're going to do? We're going to slap a bag valve mask on this person, and we're going to give them 100% O2, which will reoxygenate their system. So in the meantime, someone can jump on that chest and continue maintaining perfusion with the oxygen present in their system and in their lungs while help is on the way. And these are the patients that are most viable. These are the patients that had sudden collapse, that if we can do anything we can to maintain perfusion, maintain cardiac perfusion specifically, that when help gets there, these patients are most likely going to still be in a shockable rhythm. Okay? These patients, if they are able to be saved, will still be in that V-fib rhythm. And AED pads can go on them quickly, and they can be shocked. And then CPR is continued, oxygenation is continued, and you go through the process. So that's what the new cardiac guidelines for the American Heart Association are. They look specifically at a single situation, a witnessed arrest managed by bystanders until healthcare providers arrive. What this means for you is that if you show up and you have a barrier device, you're going to jump in and begin doing ventilations while you have the bystanders do the compressions. Why? Compressions are easy. I can teach somebody compressions in like 10 seconds. Tell them where to put their hands on the chest. Watch the person before them. Talk about it while the person's doing their 30 compressions. Jump in, do your 2 breaths. Sit back up, let them do 30 more. Get somebody else there ready watching, thinking about it, practicing it in their mind. Then when the time comes, they jump on the chest, give you 2 breaths, they go right back in, and you coach them through the first set of 30, do your 2 more breaths, and by the time they've done 5 sets of 30, they're an expert. So there you go. That's the gist of what I talked about with Shirley and the other people that were listening in live over at the MedicCast Live Stump the Pod Medic episode this past week. Again, I continue on and talk about some of the international response, and then I go back and I start talking about some of the continuing education classes that I recommend, things like PEP or PHTLS or AMLS. You can find out more about what I talked about over at the MedicCast Live. And I want to thank Shirley and Eddie and Jim and Mark and everybody else that was available and listening in over at the MedicCast Live this past week. It was a lot of fun, and I think I'll probably set up something similar to that next month. And that's going to wrap up this episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for taking the time to check out the show and listen in to what we had going on today. If you are interested in finding out more information or links to anything I talked about in this particular episode, head over to MedicCast.com/blog. And at the blog there, you will find links to the show notes and the podcast category for this episode and every single of the 114 episodes of the MedicCast. So you can go way back and check on things. You can also search the database for different topics. If you're interested in seeing other things that you might be looking for, you can check there. If you can't find it, send me an email and I will try to find it for you if I have done it in the past. You can reach me by email at podmedic@mac.com, podmedic@mac.com, and shoot me an email and ask me questions or send me corrections or suggestions for other shows. And you can do that. I always look forward to getting email from the listeners. Of course, as you heard this particular episode, I always like and enjoy getting emails and voicemails from listeners. Voicemail line for the MedicCast. You can call in and leave a message at 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. And that is a Skype-based voicemail. Skype is the voiceover internet phone service. So if you are on Skype, you can also reach me and leave a message there by going to the Skype ID PodMedic. That's all lowercase. PodMedic is my Skype ID. Incidentally, if you're on Facebook or MySpace, you can also find me at PodMedic, and you can certainly friend me up over at those places and check out some of the things I have posted over at my MySpace and Facebook pages. Don't be afraid to get in touch with me, friend me up over there, and I always look forward to hearing from the listeners of the show, however they might be trying to get in touch with me. Of course, don't forget to check out the MedicCast forums, a great way for you to check out each other and find out a little bit more about the questions you may have from other listeners of the show. Share your answers with them. They'll share their answers with you. And it's a great way to keep in touch with the community here at the MedicCast. I do check in over there from time to time, although you may not always get an answer directly from me. There are great people over there that are very active in the forums. So head to forums.medicast.com and you can share your questions, your comments, your suggestions all over at the MedicCast forums. Well, okay, that's it. Enough for me, folks. I'm chattering on. I'm going to go ahead and get out of your hair. I am going to end up, I'm feeling in kind of a rock and roll kind of mood today. So we're going to wrap up with some great PodSafe music from an artist by the name of Sofia Ramos. We've played Sofia's song Esperanza here before. You've probably recognized it if you've been listening to the show for a while, but I'm in the mood for a little bit of Sofia's rock and roll and guitar riffs, so I'm going to end up tonight with her song Esperanza. If you like what you hear, head over to the show notes, click on her link, and let Sofia Ramos know you heard her song here on the MedicCast. I'll wrap up as I always do and say, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, folks, remember, scene safety, BSI.